From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a recent Reuters Ipsos poll. Here's the Newsweek headline that came from that poll. Many Americans have more in common with white nationalists than they think, poll finds. And here's what the poll actually found. Ask people if they support the alt-right, and only 6% say yes. But ask if they support ideas often espoused by the alt-right, and the numbers start to change. Only 70% said they strongly agree that people of different races should be free to live wherever they choose and that all races are equal. 11% said they don't think all races should be treated equally. 31% said they think the United States needs to protect and preserve its white European heritage. Nearly 33% said they could not support interracial marriage, while 16% said that marriage specifically should mean two people from the same race. I could go on. 39% said they worry that white people are under attack in this country. How many white people support Black Lives Matter? The poll finds the answer to be 26%. The point is, we harbor our own divisions, and so this hour, we want to have a conversation with a woman who has explored what divides us in depth, and she also has ideas about what unites us. She's a filmmaker, Rochester-based, who's done multiple pieces and films over the years. Her newest film that she's working on is about racism. Her name is Mara Ahmed, and her latest film that's out is called A Thin Wall, exploring the impact of partition in India and Pakistan. Let me start by just saying thank you for being here. I had a chance to watch A Thin Wall over the last couple of days, and I really appreciate your insight here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I introduced you as a filmmaker and an artist. I mean, I guess that's right. How do you introduce yourself?
That's actually a good question. Whenever I speak to students, I always tell them that I see myself as an activist filmmaker. Naomi Klein often talks about being an activist journalist. And so I can really relate to that because I feel that activism and the struggle for social justice is really at the core of anything I do, whether it be writing, art, or film.
She's given also a TEDx talk that you might have heard in Rochester about borders and the way we divide ourselves and sort of the arbitrary nature of those divisions and how to rise above that. So what I want to do is kind of work through your own biography, which I think plays out not just in the film A Thin Wall, but also I think informs some of your work. Before we get there, though, can I get your reaction to some of those numbers from the Reuters Ipsos poll that said, you know, Americans say, I'm not the alt-right, but then you start asking them, and there are more Americans than we like to think who feel this way, Mara.
I think it depends a lot on the kind of information that they're getting and the kinds of probably personal interactions that they have. Are they exposed to diversity? What kind of places do they live in an urban setting, in a rural setting? Do they encounter difference? I think these kinds of things make a big difference.
I think there's an idea in the alt-right that not encountering difference is a good thing, that difference is dangerous, that multiculturalism is dangerous. And your film, A Thin Wall, I think goes a long way to trying to take apart that notion and actually flip it on its head. So let's kind of work through your own background and then we'll work it into the film, which I think is fascinating. You grew up where?
I was born in Pakistan, in Lahore, which is a beautiful ancient city, probably older than Paris. And a very organic, very vibrant city, which was always kind of the center of the arts and culture in the Indian subcontinent. So that's where I was born. But when I was quite young, we actually moved to Brussels. My father worked at the Pakistani embassy there for quite a long time. And so I grew up, French was the first language that I learned to read and write. And so I grew up speaking French, thinking in French, reading everything in French. And then moved back to Pakistan when I was a teenager, went to high school there, went to college there. And then got married in the 1990s and moved to the United States and have been here ever since.
And been making a number of films. And so A Thin Wall, is it available for people to see, by the way?
Yeah, A Thin Wall. Actually, I'm glad you asked that question because recently it was put on Amazon Movies. So people can actually, for like $3 or something like that, they can go on Amazon and watch the film.
It's an hour long. And if you're like me and you don't know the history of partition, or if you know only the very, very surface level basics, it takes you in sometimes heartbreaking ways through the impact on families and people I think that you knew well and what happened in 1947. So can you do a brief, I hate to do this because I don't want to oversimplify, but can you give a brief history lesson of partition, and then we're going to kind of work through how this relates in so many ways to these themes?
Yes. So in 1940, so the Indian subcontinent, which is most of South Asia, was a British colony for almost 200 years. And in 1947, they finally left the Indian subcontinent. But at the same time that they were leaving, they also drew this line, which was quite an arbitrary line that went, that kind of went across roads and through villages and sometimes even cutting a house so that half of it was in one country and the other half in another country. And created a Muslim-majority Pakistan and a Hindu-majority India. And they did that at the same time that they were leaving. So the British Army had been decommissioned prior to the partition. There was a complete lack of order or any kind of administration or any kind of regulation. And in the midst of this, this line is drawn in, through this land, which has always been extremely, extremely diverse, multicultural, multi-religious. And so what happens is that people begin to move across this line, particularly in the Punjab and in Bengal. That's where the lines were drawn. And so the Muslims start to move towards the Muslim majority country. The Hindus and Sikhs start to move towards the Hindu majority country. And in the midst of this chaos, riots break out, and about 1 million people are killed in a few months, and about, people say, 12 to 20 million people are displaced.
This was a time, as your film shows, when people who were forced to move were getting on trains not knowing if the train would be attacked.
Yeah, so that was kind of a, it's a very characteristic thing that happened during partition, is that as the, there would be these special trains that would take people across the border from one state, newly formed state, to another newly formed state. And it was pretty certain that a train coming from what had now become Pakistan would be full of Hindus who were trying to move to India. And it would be pretty sure that a train going in the opposite direction towards Pakistan would be full of Muslims. So what would happen is that the train right before it crossed the border would be derailed, it would be stopped, and everyone on board would be killed.
Before that, though, in those decades preceding 1947 and partition, your film interviews a number of people who were born in the 1920s and the 1930s, who were growing up in those times. And as you say, living in a very multicultural place, multicultural, yes, multi-religion. And can you describe as best you can, and certainly from their experience, but also from your own learning and scholarship, what life was like before partition?
So my mother's family was actually impacted by the partition. My mom was very young in 1947. She was 5 years old. But it's interesting that her memories are actually so precise and so vivid, even though she was so young. And I feel like it's almost, my understanding of it is that perhaps the experience was so traumatic that it became imprinted on her brain. And so she talks about them being this Muslim family that was the only Muslim family living in a neighborhood that was exclusively Hindu. And I don't think that this was something very unusual. And so coexistence was something that was possible and had been going on for a very long time in India.
But living safely in a neighborhood that was,
yes,
mostly Hindu?
Yes, living extremely safely. And in fact, when the partition happened and when riots broke out and when there were these attacks on homes where people were being killed, it was my mother's father's friends and colleagues and neighbors who were all Hindus who helped my mother's family get out of Gurgaon and into Pakistan.
This film, for those who fear multiculturalism and think that logically we can do whatever we can to try to ward off the fear and otherism that happens, but eventually when you mix cultures and races and religions together, you get strife. That's one of the views of the alt-right these days. And this film demonstrates that kind of the opposite was true, that on the Indian subcontinent you had multiculturalism and it was not filled with rioting and pain and suffering and all kinds of problems. And then partition happens ostensibly to create more homogenous places, but in the course of doing that, it leads to violence. It kind of turns the fear on its head, I think.
Yes, and I want to quote Rabindranath Tagore, actually, because he wrote this really interesting essay on nationalism, and this was much earlier, I think in 1917 or something like that. And he actually was very suspicious of the whole idea of nationalism, and he felt that this was a very Western concept, and that if this Western concept was transplanted into India, it would be a very, very poor fit for India. And the way that he describes it is that nationalism is almost, is something which is very suited to capitalism, because the word that he uses is bales of humanity, because it creates these very uniform, scientifically labeled, I think these are actually some of his words, bales of humanity, which are, humanity is siloed and categorized and labeled. And it works beautifully for capitalism because it's obviously a very efficient system. But he says this is going to be horrendous for India, because India is so multicultural, multi-religious. It is so ancient and so used to absorbing all these contradictions and living with all these contradictions that you, if you impose such a system on India, it will be disastrous. So that's exactly what happened at the time of partition.
And it was led to the creation of a country, Pakistan, around 30 million people, India more than 300 million, I think, at the time, in 1947.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the numbers, but yeah.
Obviously, India, a much larger country. But so partition happens in 1947. And listeners, not only, I think, is this a useful history exercise for us who don't know the history, but also as we continue to work through Mara's work as an artist, how it informs our understanding of human nature, our ability to live as a multicultural society, and what it says about our own tendencies. And we've got a lot to work through. If you want to call the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. And I told Mara before the program that one of our listeners watched your TED Talk, your TEDx Talk, on the subject of borders, and he identifies as a white nationalist, and he wants to push back on some of what we're hearing now. So let me go ahead and read this, and we'll let Mara Ahmed go ahead and respond to this. Our listener writes the following, quote, she says, those that didn't fit in were forcefully integrated by state violence, but by the state? Why did the state decide that? The state didn't bother to do that when the British ran it. Why then? No, it wasn't the state. This wasn't soldiers. The new governments couldn't collect taxes, much less organize an army. This was the violence of the mob, of a riot. It wasn't the state forcing those who didn't fit in to integrate. It was regular people. This wasn't top-down. It was bottom-up. Any state violence there might have been a reflection of the populace and their desire to forcefully integrate the other or expel him. She goes on to say that partition was supposed to take care of the minority problem. She's conceding there is a minority problem. Partition was demanded by the Muslim minority, so it sounds like they conceded there was a problem to being a minority too. And so he goes on to say he believes that it could have been much more bloodshed had nothing changed at all with partition. He says maybe 30 million would have died if eventually, how long before, the Muslims would have left or the Sikhs chafed under Hindu rule and kicked off the full-scale civil war and eventual partition anyway. So he's challenging some of what you're presenting as sort of a mostly peaceful multicultural society that was pushed into partition, 1 million to 2 million die, and we've had strife ever since. He's saying that was going to happen anyway. And by the way, the 1 in 2 million who died, that wasn't the state doing the violence, it was the violence of the mob. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, what he's saying is actually aligns perfectly with this Orientalist trope that the violence was coming from people's, from the natives, that it was coming from the natives', you know, religious fervor, that that's what was motivating the violence. That's actually not true. And if you read some of the new work, a lot of it is actually done by women historians from India and from Pakistan, you find out that the violence was actually, a lot of it was organized and makes actually a lot of sense. It's very logical in a way that this happened. First of all, the British left India in a big hurry. They were not interested in India anymore at that time. So everything was very hurried and it was done very sloppily, very messily. So even if partition had to happen, it could have happened in a much more structured and disciplined and organized way, which it didn't happen. So I hold the British responsible for that. That was very negligent on their part and very cruel. The second thing is that A lot of the violence that happened in the Punjab. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is that the line was drawn through the Punjab. So it was the body of the Punjab that was mutilated in 1947. But another reason for that is also that a lot of the decommissioned soldiers, I told you that the army had already been decommissioned prior to partition, were Punjabis. They were based in the Punjab. And so a lot of the violence that happened was, in fact, organized. Many people that even we interviewed, or if you read Urvashi Bhutalia's book or any other historian's book who have collected oral histories, you find out that people talk about the violence coming from the outside, from outside their villages, from outside of their towns, people that they didn't know, who were trying to start something. And so, that again supports the fact that a lot of this violence was, in fact, organized.
But organized
by
whom?
It wasn't spontaneous.
Organized by whom, though?
By parties on both sides, by people who were invested in the separation, who were invested in the formation of nation states.
Trying to take power?
Trying to take power, yes, and also trying to ethnically cleanse, making the most of, this chaos that had been created at the time of partition.
But do you dispute the idea that this attempt at ethnic cleansing would have happened anyway if a society as multicultural as the Indian subcontinent had continued to exist without partition?
No, because nothing like that had ever happened before. However, in the history of the Indian subcontinent, which is quite a lot of history to go through, things like that have happened after the partition. So, for example, in the 1980s and in the 1990s, there were similar types of riots and similar types of violence that happened in India, sometimes directed at the Sikh population, sometimes directed at the Muslim population. And many people say that when they saw this violence, it reminded them of the partition, that it was exactly the same. And so this particular kind of violence, this particular kind of barbarity is something that we saw after the partition. Nothing like that had happened before. And of course, I'm not saying that everything was hunky-dory prior to the partition. Of course, I think it's just a human conflict is something which is human. So there's conflict within families. We have conflict with our parents. We have conflict with our siblings. We sometimes have conflict with our neighbors. So conflict or difference of opinion is something which is very human. So of course, in India as well, there was conflict. There's conflict everywhere. So I'm not saying that everything was absolutely perfect, but this kind of violence was not something that we had experienced before.
The film that we're talking about is called The Thin Wall. And available on Amazon. My guest, Mara Ahmed, is our guest, and we're going to move on to some other subjects in a moment. But just to sort of close the loop on why I wanted to hit this point, some listeners are surprised to hear, you interact with people who are sort of white nationalists, alt-right. I think there are some people who are cartoonishly white nationalists, who are sort of knee-jerk, fearful of anybody who is not white and sort of that classic cartoonish racist. And I don't really have a whole lot of time or patience for that. But then I hear from people who are fearful of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. And what Mara's film does is it reminds us that right now we are being taught multiculturalism is dangerous, or some are teaching that multiculturalism is dangerous. But you're trying to lay a historical case to say you don't have to believe that partition is necessary or that it is more peaceful or that it is better along any grounds, I think.
Yeah, so I mean, if you look, that's why I think that the partition of India, when I was making this film, many people said, well, why should American audiences be interested in this film? Isn't this film just about South Asia? And I don't agree with that at all, because I think this film, or the partition of India in 1947 is such an important template that we must study in order to understand what's happening in the world right now. So it's a colonial partition, which happened in many different parts of the world, in the Middle East, in the continent of Africa. And the same kind of MO was used in those countries when it came to partition. These partitions were based on some kind of colonial logic. It made colonial sense, but it actually did not make any sense for the people living on the ground. And so that's true of all of these colonial partitions. And also it tells us about nationalism. It tells us about the formation of nation states. It tells us about ethnic cleansing. It tells us a lot about the creation of refugees, which is still a very big problem today. So I think it's a topic that's very, very important and that we really need to study in depth. And what it shows is that like you said, the very justification, the very raison d'être for a nation state is that there's some kind of homogeneity, whether it be ethnic or cultural or racial or religious. But then what we forget is that this homogeneity is usually an illusion. There's always some difference, even within the most homogeneous of countries. And so what happens to these minorities once you establish this kind of nationalism, which is very, very homogeneous?
Okay, so this is maybe the most important part of the hour here. And I'm going to come to your phone calls in a moment, Roger. I promise we're going to get there in a second. But what Mara is touching on, there's a couple of things. First of all, even if human history showed no capacity or very little capacity to exist relatively peacefully in a multicultural sense, I would be making the argument that would say we can grow up. We didn't always cook Blue Apron. We hunted and gathered for a while. I mean, there was a lot that we didn't do that we now do. If we have shown no capacity to get over cultural, religious, racial difference, I would still argue that we can. And we must, because of travel, transportation, and the way modern societies are constructing. We don't really have a choice here.
Also, if I could add,
yes.
Globalization. So
yes.
For now, I mean, globalization has already happened, which means that capital is actually very mobile. It moves very easily, you know, across borders. And so it becomes very easy for us to make obscene amounts of profits because capital is now so mobile. But when capital becomes mobile and it goes into other countries and into other markets and into other societies and impacts them, then there's also going to be some movement of people. And that is something that we push back against. So on the one hand, we do want our capital to be very mobile. We do want access to all these markets. We do want to make a lot of profit. But we don't. But when we dislocate people or when we put people out of work, we don't want those people then to move.
And so when you talk about the homogeneity of various forms that ostensibly are the basis for nation states, mm-hmm. our country is changing. And some people are fearful of that. You talk about what happens to minorities in countries. What is the message you have on two fronts? Number one, for how we as an American society view minorities, and I guess for white people who are fearful, as reflected in this poll. And number two, how you view borders to begin with. You know, borders, as you kind of lay out the case, whether it's Iraq or India and Pakistan, Kashmir and so many other places, there's a lot of arbitrariness that has kind of come to setting borders, and then we sort of gather around them. How do you view borders to begin with? So these are two big questions, but let's hit these and then we'll come to the phone calls. Go ahead.
So in terms of minorities and in terms of this being a white country, I mean, even that is very problematic for me because this was not like just empty land that we came and occupied. There were people living here on this land, the indigenous peoples of this land. And so how can you even say that this is a white country? Those people had been living here for a very, very long time. They are the original owners of this land and all of these resources that we are now using. So I always want to be very clear that, you know, this is a settler colonial state, and there were people here when we decided to come and settle this land. And so this is not a white country in any case. Yes, since settler colonialism, there has been a lot of immigration from all over the world, a lot of it from Europe, and I guess that would be a lot of white people who came over. But there's also been immigration from many other countries. Even Muslims, you know, for example, are seen as being relatively new to this land, and many times they are talked about as being from somewhere else. But in fact, Muslims have been here since the beginning of colonialism. Many of the slaves that were brought here were actually Muslim and built this country in many ways. So there have been people coming here from all over the world from the very beginning. Like even in the 1500s, I believe that there was a Muslim slave revolt, which was led by a Muslim. And that was like in the 1500s. So just saying that only white people from Europe have lived here is also, I think, an exaggeration. And then not remembering that this is a settler colonial state, that this land actually belongs to the indigenous people of the Americas, I think is a very big mistake. We should always have that context when we talk about, you know, the demographics of this country or the history of this country.
I think your film, A Thin Wall, tells us that the homogeneity that some talk about is mostly a myth, that, you know, even if you look at sort of racial purity, white people get tests and they find out all the time, oh, I'm not 100% white. I didn't know. And this notion of purity, this notion of homogeneity tends to be a myth.
Yes, it is. It is a myth because we are all very mixed. And like Rabindranath Tagore was saying, I think it's not even just India that's like that. That's, you know, so multi-religious, multicultural, and is used to absorbing so much contradiction. I think the whole world is like that. And like you said, even within ourselves, we are so. And that's something I talk about in my TED talk. That even within ourselves, there's so much otherness. There's so much diversity. There are so many contradictions. All of us are like that.
So when it comes to this notion of looking at partition and dividing along certain lines of homogenous territories, I don't know where you draw the line. Do you do it at race? Do you do it at religion? I mean, are you allowed to be the same race but different religions, the same religion but different races? It falls apart so quickly that I don't know how it would ever be enforceable. It just seems...
Exactly. We would just end up with a country of one person each. If you really go into the details of it.
Are there values of borders and considering ourselves nation states?
No, I'm very suspicious of nation states. And, you know, many times I think people just assume that nation states are the pillars of human civilization. It's actually not true. Nation states are not more than a few hundred years old. And again, I'm very suspicious of nation states because I think, like I said, that the very demarcation of nation states is very much based in the very justification for nation states is very much based in some kind of ethnic or religious or cultural or racial purity, which, you know, I don't believe in. So
I want to take some phone calls from our listeners. I'm going to start with Mary in Rochester. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Evan. Thank you. I'd just like to say that I'm a landscape architect and I study ecological systems, and I've even taught courses on how we can apply resiliency theory created in the realm of landscape ecology to cities and societies. And the important takeaway is that diversity is always a sign of strength and resiliency. And creating a system that's non-diverse is just going to create a condition whereby the diversity begins to spontaneously generate itself. It's true for a forest and it's true for a country as well. So once you get everyone all the same in a country, they're going to start to diversify because that's the nature of biological beings and biological systems. So I think that if there was some way that this could be transmitted, that it is a weakening effect to try to homogenize, I think that we could learn about how to make our societies more resilient by diversity.
Mary, what an interesting phone call. Thank you for taking the time to share that with the program. Mara, what do you make of that?
I think that's a beautiful idea because, in fact, it's true that even in biology, diversity is so important. That's how species survive, in fact, is through diversity. It's through having a lot of different kinds of traits. And then some of those traits, you know, adapt very well to the environment. But if you didn't have that, if everything was exactly the same, if nothing evolved, if nothing changed, then we wouldn't even have survived as a species. So I think that's actually a beautiful analogy.
All right, let me get to Lydia in Rochester next. Go ahead, Lydia.
Hi. I admire your work, Mara, and I'm glad that you're on WXXI today to talk about the film that you have been working on. I just wanted to say, because I'm from the Philippines, and in the Philippines we do have some problems in regards to the Muslim population and the regular population. And I just wanted to say that before the colonial colonialization of the Philippines by the Spanish, we did not have that problem. Of course, we weren't a one-state nation. But after the colonialization and the divide and conquer of the colonialist masters, then there began a problem of between the Christians and the Muslims. And mainly that wasn't the way it was before. It was because they were working, both were working for their liberation as a country, as people. That's when the divide and conquer tactics came from Spain, and eventually later on also from the United States, which also became the colonial masters of the Philippines. So basically, it is not natural for the people to fight each other, but the cooperation and to survive is the most important aspect of survival of human beings. And yet, because of the divide and conquer tactics of the colonial masters, that's when those things happen. And here in the United States, we really have to be in solidarity with all the people who are victims of of racism and the organizing against the immigrants from the state. So, I guess the best thing to do is to be able to provide solidarity and to support one another.
Thank you for saying that.
Lydia, thank you very much for the phone call. Mark, can you tell people before we get our only break of the hour, we'll come back. Bernard, we'll take your call. We'll take some more calls from listeners if you want to join the discussion. And we'll talk more about what she's got going on now, an art installation out in Oakland. You got another project you're working on now, a film project on racism. Where's the easiest way for people to access your work?
Actually, if they just Google me, I'm all over the internet. I'm on Facebook. I have a website. So if they just Google Mara Ahmed.
And Ahmed is spelled A-H-M-E-D. A film on Islamophobia from 2008. Called what?
The Muslims I Know.
The Muslims I Know. And A Thin Wall is a 2015 film on borders separation. We've been talking about partition. After our only break of the hour, we'll come back, take another one of your phone calls, and then we'll talk about the current project on the subject of racism. We'll talk Islamophobia, how you see it in the United States today, and much more with Mara Ahmed on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, there is already one empty stadium in Rochester, with the Rochester Rhinos sitting out at least the 2018 season. But the Rochester Red Wings will not be moving somewhere else. We learned yesterday afternoon, Monroe County and the team have an agreement to stay. That's good news for baseball fans. We'll also talk about community values, making sure there's activity downtown. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest for the hour is an activist filmmaker and artist, Mara Ahmed, who is from Lahore, Pakistan, by way of Belgium, by way of Pakistan, and here to Rochester. So it's very nice to have her in studio with us. And before we get back to your phone calls, she wanted to hit on a couple of points. Lydia's call, you said there were a number of moments in those calls where you found yourself really relating to the points. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Actually, in my film, In a Thin Wall, which is about the partition of India, I don't really want to talk a lot about the politics of the partition, because I feel that that's how the partition has been mostly talked about, is in terms of these very larger-than-life male figures like Gandhi, Nehru, Jinnah, Mountbatten, and we didn't want to do that in the film. However, we did want to give it some political context, and the way that we did that was that we located the partition very much at the center of colonialism, and so that's what Lydia was doing as well, and I completely agree that the divide and rule policy of the colonizers is something that, in fact, in India and Pakistan, two countries between which there's quite a lot of hostility still, that we are still, in a way, dealing with that policy. The first census that happened in the Indian subcontinent happened like in the 1800s. It was a survey that was carried out by the British. This is something that they always do whenever they colonize a place, they like to do a survey. And so this was really the first time that Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, the Jewish people in India were asked to put themselves in a particular religious box. Prior to that, people in the Indian subcontinent tended to see themselves in terms of the region that they belonged to. So if you were Punjabi, you spoke Punjabi, you had a particular, you know, culture, you had a particular literature, cuisine, a particular sense of humor. And so you connected across religious lines to other people who were from the Punjab. Similarly, if you're from the Bengal, you know, you connected with people who were from the Bengal in terms of language, culture, food. And it didn't really, it was quite irrelevant what people's religions were. It was not such a big part of people's identities. However, once that census happened, that was really, I feel, the first time that Indians, in a way, questioned their own multiplicities. And I feel that that was, in a way, the beginning of what happened in 1947.
And so when you use the word diversity, how do you define it?
So I'm actually very interested in diversity. And I have been reading a lot from Patrick Chamoiseau and Edouard Glissant. And these are French writers, poets, and philosophers who are from the Martinique, from the Caribbean. And they write a lot. They actually have done work on the aesthetics of diversity or the linguistics, the poetics of diversity, because they're trying to find a language which actually is able to talk about diversity in a real and intelligent way. And so what they say is that diversity, like I think in the United States, many times when we think of diversity, we just think of like a happy melting pot or a jolly mishmash where we just try each other's foods and, you know, we have a really good time. We listen to each other's music. But I think diversity is a bit more complex and a bit deeper than that. Diversity is really about differences constantly encountering each other, constantly negotiating with each other, constantly adjusting and changing each other. And so you're always moving towards like this unpredictable outcome. And I think that's the way to look at diversity. It's something actually extremely dynamic and beautiful and full of energy. It's not just eating, biryani and feeling that, you know, now you support diversity.
And I want to, before I grab Bernard's phone call on Twitter, Don, I think maybe responding to how you described some of your concerns with how partition happened, the way he's hearing it is this. You were upset with how the British government handled sort of removing themselves, did it in a reckless way that led to this vacuum and this strife. But Don is saying, but okay, they should have known that the different cultures would be at each other's throats. How does this make me want more multiculturalism? Don, here's how I heard Mara describing it. You had a multicultural society that wasn't perfect, but lived pretty harmoniously, all things considered. And when the British left, 1947 and partition happens, you had people who are opportunistically looking for power. And so it is a pretty human tendency when power is available to try to seize power and to try to pit one another against one another based on differences. And what I hear Mara describing and the film described is not that it should have been obvious that the cultures couldn't live together, but when there is a power vacuum and there are strong forces at play, sometimes they do divide along certain more homogenous lines or find lines to draw and find ways to pit one another against one
another. Exactly. There's always like extremist groups. There are extremist groups here in the United States. There are always groups like that, that follow some kind of very extreme, very pure ideology. And so there were people like that in the Indian subcontinent as well. And so like you said, when there was this complete vacuum and there was complete chaos, they took advantage of that in order to come in and get as much power as they, you know, as they could.
It's a vote in favor of egalitarianism. In terms of the likelihood of people in power using others' differences against one another, and in more egalitarian societies, the idea that that would happen less often. I want to get Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, I'm sorry to be bothering you so much lately.
No. Go ahead.
I just wanted to simplify this a little bit. I appreciate the intelligence that's been going on in this conversation, but it seems to me, and you actually kind of talked about this a little earlier, it seems to me that when Hitler wanted to take over Germany, he created the against the Jews. It seems to me that Trump, when he wanted to take over the United States, he's created against reporters, and now he's creating against Muslims. So it seems to me that one of the things we have to be aware of is that while there's the intelligence way the world should work, unfortunately, there's this ignorance, if you will, ability to take over control requires or works because these people are willing to be ignorant and prejudiced. Hmm. Thanks very much.
Bernard, thank you. How much do you think, Mara, education comes into play when it comes to racism?
I think education is really important. I think the kind of culture, the kind of environment that you grow up in is really important. Because as you know, race itself is a construct. It's not really something which is real. So obviously, if it's something which is invented, then it's something that has to be taught to you. So yeah, absolutely. It's something that that can be taught to you and that can also be untaught by getting the correct information.
What are you working on now when it comes to filmmaking and racism?
So I'm working on a film about racism, which is obviously a very, very broad topic. And so I'm approaching it in a very specific way. The film is inspired by the work of Claudia Rankine, who is this beautiful poet. And it's specifically inspired by her book called Citizen, an American Lyric, which is a collection of poems. And I'm only interviewing women for this film. I think that with women, there are just so many different layers of oppression. I mean, there's race, but there's class, but there's also gender. And so I think that women are just very interesting to talk to. And I will be interviewing very, very diverse women from many different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different religions. Arab women, Latina women, Black women, of course, a lot of Asian women. And I'm also going to be using dance in the film. So I actually worked on a project with Mariko Yamada, who is this beautiful choreographer. And we did a very short piece for the Fringe Festival in which we used clips from some of the interviews that I had done for this film on racism. And then we combined that with dance. And it just made me realize how dance, in a way, is so beautifully aligned with the topic of racism, because the body has everything to do with racism. The body is the way that you see someone or you racially code someone in order to be racist towards them. But the body is also what carries racism in itself. It carries that pain in itself. And so breathing, for example, I was reading Frantz Fanon, and Fanon talks about how colonialism changes people's breathing, that the colonized, that the people who are oppressed, breathe very, very shallowly. He calls it combat breathing, like the kind of breathing that soldiers would do on the battlefield. And dance is a lot about breathing. So I just thought that it was just a beautiful way of, in a way, telling another strand of the story through dance.
Now, this film, you consider yourself an activist filmmaker and artist. So do you go in with a point of view that you want to share, or do you go in trying to learn in this case and then sort of share what you find?
I always kind of know what the message of the overall general message of the film will be. I know that. But I don't really know what the story is going to be. I'm not one of those filmmakers who has a script ahead of time and then they go looking for certain things that they want in their film. When I interview people, I'm very, very open. So I don't really know where the story is going to go and in what direction. And it's really when I'm editing, because I edit my films myself, that's really when all the material kind of comes together and it just, the story kind of, the narrative starts to take shape. So I'm very organic in the way that I work with material.
And speaking of, we mentioned it earlier, 2008 film, Muslim Like Me. Tell us, our listeners, what they missed.
The Muslims I Know?
Oh, well, I'm sorry, The Muslims I Know, yes.
So that was my first film that came out in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people that I actually became a filmmaker in order to make that film. So obviously my background, I think I mentioned I have a degree in economics and I have a degree in business. So I've always worked in finance. But in 2004, I actually quit my job and decided to go back to school and study art because art is my true love and my true passion. And I was happier than ever. I had never thought about making a film at that point. But then the Islamophobia that was coming out of mainstream media, this barrage, this flood of Islamophobia and misinformation that was coming out was really very difficult for me to take. And I kept saying to my husband, someone needs to make a film that shows, the real Islam, that shows real Muslims. I'm a Muslim. Most of the people I know are Muslims. And I felt that even though people were talking about us, we were not allowed to be a part of that conversation. So the only way that I felt that I could give a platform to other Muslims to speak for themselves in their own voices was to make an independently funded film. And so I went to school, I learned filmmaking, and I made my first film, The Muslim Zaino, which came out in 2008.
When it comes to you using that phrase, the real Muslims, is there anything sort of fraught with using that term? I mean, religions are made of people, and people are whatever, they can make religions whatever they make of it. That is not to say that what you were pushing back against, probably the portrayal of Muslims as largely extremist, often involved with terrorism.
Yes.
That is not to say that that is fair on the broad scale, but the small number that espouse those beliefs, are they not Muslims?
Well, you have all kinds of Muslims, just like you have all kinds of Christians. I mean, some Christian
sure.
people have pretty vile views,
yes,
right?
Yes, indeed.
And very, like, barbaric views. And the same goes for the Jewish population or the Hindu population or the Buddhist population, as we're seeing, you know, we're seeing what's happening mm-hmm. with the Rohingyas. So, there are good and bad people in every religion. And so when I say real Muslim, the only thing that I'm trying to separate normal, real Muslims from the very unidimensional cardboard stereotypes that we are being fed through the media. So I'm trying to separate normal, real Muslims from those stereotypes. That's why I use that word.
You were inspired to make that film during the last decade. More than a decade later, how do you feel about the way more Muslims are portrayed now?
I'm divided on that. I do feel that, I personally know a lot of really fantastic, absolutely brilliant Muslim activists who are doing amazing work, who have a very refined understanding of intersectionality, for example, and are doing grassroots work with communities. And that really gives me hope. On the other hand, I also feel that the Islamophobia industry, which is, in fact, a multi-million dollar industry that produces a lot of the information that we're seeing in mainstream media, has become more established and better funded over the years. And so it's very difficult to go against it.
All right, I'm going to get a phone call. I think this is Tabassum and Victor. Next up on the show, go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum, Mara. Wonderful show. I just caught
at end
of the program when you were talking about whose land it is, and I just fully concur with that when you were talking about the indigenous people and how people were settled here,
yes,
and how their claim to the land supersedes anybody else's claim to the land.
Absolutely.
But but the reason I'm calling is about the Islamophobia and all the situations that we are still running into. And I think what has happened is that a lot of people have not been made aware of the contribution that Muslims have made in this country. We may be 3 or 4 million in terms of the population, mm-hmm. but according to the AMA, the American Medical Association, 12% of all the physicians in America right now are Muslims. So that's a very significant statistic to look at. Now, in terms of the immigrant contribution, 1/3 of the Fortune 500 companies are either started or led by immigrants, And we don't have to go too far. We talk about Microsoft, you can talk about Apple, you can talk about so many others. And so this is the kind of message that doesn't go through. And the other, messages that Mara was talking about in terms of the negative stereotype, that pretty much gets blown out of proportion. Similarly, when it comes to incidents of terrorism, domestic terrorism, nobody ever, I never saw anybody in the news media say that this Southern Baptist, from Las Vegas is the one who just went and mowed down so many people. Or I didn't hear anybody say that, Southern Baptist Christian in a church in South Carolina just went to a Bible study class and killed everybody around there. This is like, because of these things, the messages, the association in the media almost becomes, like our president tweeted, fake videos of people who were, doing these violent acts towards other people, and they were portrayed as Muslims, and that was not the case, so that kind of thing. And so that is the couple of points I want to make. Also, the FBI statistics is very evident. Hate crimes against the Muslims have gone up 28%. So
yes,
that's a significant rise in that category too. And there are, you don't hear about all the stuff that goes on, but there are sporadic examples throughout the nation where Muslims have paid open discrimination. And so, the only thing that makes me hopeful is that we're going to make our voices louder and louder and louder and be able to, quell the propaganda on the other side.
Tabassum, thank you for the phone call. And we're down to about our last minute. I see in horror there. I looked up and went, wow, it's 12:56. So if you want to share some thoughts on what Tabassum had to say and then some final thoughts from you, Mara, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say on Islamophobia. That's actually one of the themes or things that I'm interested in. So I talk a lot about it. And yes, the contributions that Muslims have made, of course, the understanding of Muslim history in America, which is very much also a Black history, which I feel that people usually don't make that connection, that the largest and oldest contingent of Muslims in this country is actually Black. So that's very important. And the fact that terrorist attacks made by Muslims are nothing in number, if you look at the numbers, as compared to attacks or hate crimes or terrorism committed by right-wing extremists. So I think that's an important point. The diversity within the Muslim community is just amazing. There are 50 countries in the world that are Muslim majority. I think people usually don't realize that.
I think by 2040, according to recent data, Islam could be the second largest religion in the United States. It's not far away.
It's 1% right now. So if you read the whole article at the end, it says that it might be up to 2%, which is still
so,
like,
so you're not.
So 98% of the people are going to be non-Muslim still.
Okay. good perspective as always. And Mara Ahmed, you got us thinking about a lot of different things. I'm amazed at how quickly this hour has gone, but I hope you'll come back.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Mara Ahmed is an activist filmmaker and artist. Google her name, Mara, A-H-M-E-D, and you can see not only her TEDx talk, but some of her work. You can find her films, and we will certainly have her back here. Short break, more Connections coming up.